Chapter 25. Helios was not a god to be summoned, but I was the wayward daughter who had won Trigon's tale. Gods love novelty, as I have said. They are curious as cats. He stepped from the air. He was wearing his crown, and its rays turned my beach to gold. The purple of his clothes was rich as deep-pooled blood. Hundreds of years, and not a thread had changed. He was still that same image that had been seared upon me from my birth. "I am come," he said. His voice rolled like heat from a bonfire. "I seek an end to my exile," I said. "There is none. You are punished for eternity. I ask you to go to Zeus and speak on my behalf. Tell him you would take it as a favor to release me." His face was more incredulous than angry. "Why would I do such a thing?" There were many answers I might have given. "Because I have been your bargaining piece all along. Because you would have seen those men and known what they were, and still you let them land on my island. Because after, when I was a broken thing, you did not come. Because I am your daughter and would be free." He did not even pause. "Disobedient as ever and overbold, calling me here for foolishness and nothing." I looked at his face, blazing with its righteous power. The great watchman of the sky, the savior he is called. All-seeing, bringer of light, delight of men. I had given him his chance. It was more than he had ever given me. "Do you remember," I said, "when Prometheus was whipped in your hall?" His eyes narrowed. "Of course." "I stayed behind, when all the rest of you left. I brought him comfort, and we spoke together." His gaze burned into mine.
"You would not have dared."
"If you doubt me, you may ask Prometheus himself, or Aeetes, though if you get any truth from him, it is a miracle." My skin had begun to ache at his heat. My eyes watered.
"If you did such a thing, it is deepest treason. You are more owed to exile than ever. You deserve greater punishment still. All I can give you. You have exposed us to Zeus's wrath for some foolish whim."
"Yes," I said. "And if you do not see my exile ended, I will expose you again. I will tell Zeus what I did." His face contracted. For the first time in my life, I had truly shocked him.
"You would not. Zeus will destroy you."
"Perhaps he will," I said. "But I think he will listen first. And you are the one he will truly blame, for you should have kept better check on your daughter. Of course, I will tell him other things as well. All those tiptoeing treasons I heard you whisper with my uncles. I think Zeus would be glad to know how deep the Titan mutiny goes. Don't you?"
"You dare to threaten me?"
These gods, I thought. They always say the same thing. "I do." My father's skin flared, blinding bright. His voice seared at my bones.
"You would start a war." I hope so.
For I will see you torn down, father, before I will be jailed for your convenience any longer." His rage was so hot, the air bent and wavered around him.
"I can end you with a thought."
It was my oldest fear, that white annihilation. I felt it shiver through me. But enough. At last, enough.
"You can," I said.
"But you have always been cautious, father. You know I have stood against Athena. I have walked in the blackest deeps. You cannot guess what spells I have cast, what poisons I have gathered to protect myself against you, how your power may rebound upon your head. Who knows what is in me? Will you find out?" The words hung in the air. His eyes were disks of ignited gold, but I did not look away.
"If I do this thing," he said, "it is the last I will ever do for you. Do not come begging again."
"Father," I said, "I never will. I leave this place tomorrow." He would not ask where. He would not even wonder. So many years I had spent as a child, sifting his bright features for his thoughts, trying to glimpse among them one that bore my name. But he was a harp with one string, and the note it played was himself.
"You have always been the worst of my children,"
he said.
Be sure you do not dishonor me.
I have a better idea. I will do as I please. And when you count your children, leave me out. His body was rigid with wrath. He looked as though he had swallowed a stone and it choked him. Give mother my greetings, I said. His jaw bit down and he was gone. The yellow sands faded to their usual color. The shadows returned. For a moment I stood breathing, unmoving, my chest filled with a wild battering. But then it was gone. My thoughts were loosed forward, skimming the earth, flying up the hill to my room where the spear waited with its pale poison. It should have been returned to Trigon long ago, yet I had kept it for protection, and something else I could not name. At last, I knew what it was. I went up to the house and found Penelope, sitting at my loom. It is time for a decision. There are things I must do. I leave tomorrow. I cannot say for how long. I will take you first to Sparta if you would go there. She looked up from the tapestry she was making, a wild sea, with a swimmer striking out into darkness. And if I would not? Then you may stay here. She held the shuttle lightly, as if it were a bird with its hollow bones. She said, would that not intrude? I know what I have cost you. Telegonus, she meant. There was grief, and so there always would be. But the grey fog was gone. I felt distant and very clear, like a hawk borne upon the highest ether. I said, he would never have been happy here. But because of us, he went with Athena. It had hurt once. That was only pride. She is far from the worst of them. Them, I heard myself say. I give you the choice, Penelope. What would you do? A wolf stretched, her mouth squeaking a little with her yawn. I find I am in no rush for Sparta, Penelope said. Then come. There are things you must know. I led her to the kitchen with its rows of jars and bottles. There is an illusion upon the island to make it appear inhospitable to ships. That will remain while I am gone. But sailors are reckless sometimes, and the ones that are most reckless are often the most desperate. These are my drugs that do not need witchcraft. There are poisons among them and salves for healing. This one causes sleep. I handed her a bottle. It does not work immediately, so you cannot leave it till the last moment. You will need to get it in their wine. 10 drops will be enough. Do you think you can do it? She tipped the contents, felt their weight. A faint smile touched her lips. You may remember I have some experience in handling unwelcome guests. Wherever Telemachus was, he did not return for dinner. No matter, I told myself. The time when I had softened like wax was past. My path was laid before me. I packed my things. There were a few changes of clothing and a cloak, but the rest was herbs and bottles. I picked up the spear and carried it out into the warm night air. There was spell work to do, but I wanted to go to the boat first. I had not seen it since Telemachus began his repairs, and I had to be sure it was ready to sail. Streaks of lightning flashed over the sea, and the breeze brought a distant smell of fire. It was that last storm I had told Telegonus to wait for, but I did not fear it. By morning it would blow itself out. I stepped into the cave and stared. It was hard to believe I viewed the same boat. It was longer now, and its bow had been rebuilt and narrowed. The mast was better rigged, and the rudder more trim. I walked around it. At the front, a small prow piece had been added, a seated lioness with her jaws open. The fur was in the eastern style, each lock separate, curled like the shell of a snail. I reached to touch one. The wax is not set, he stepped out of the darkness. I have always thought every ship needs a prow spirit. It is beautiful, I said. I was fishing in the cove when Helios came. All the shadows disappeared. I heard you speak to him. I felt a flare of embarrassment. How baleful and outlandish and cruel we must have seemed. I rested my eyes on the boat so I would not have to look at him. Then you know my exile is ended and I sail tomorrow. I asked your mother if she would go to Sparta or stay. She said she wished to stay. I offer the same choice to you. Outside, the sea made a sound like a shuttle weaving. The stars were yellow as pears, low and ripe on the branch. I have been angry with you, he said. It surprised me.
The blood rose, stinging to my cheeks.
Angry?
Yes, he said. You thought I would go with Athena, even after all I have said to you. I am not your son, and I am not my father. You should have known I do not want anything Athena has.
His voice was even, but I felt the sharp edge of his reproach. I'm sorry, I said. I could not believe that any in this world would refuse her divinity.
That is amusing, coming from you. I am not a promising young prince of whom great things are expected. It is overrated.
I ran my hand across the lion's clawed foot, felt the sticky sheen of the wax. Do you always make beautiful things for those you are angry with?
No, he said. Only you.
Outside, the lightning flickered.
I was angry as well, I said.
I thought you could not wait to leave.
I do not know how you could think that. You know I cannot hide my face.
I could smell the beeswax, sweet and thick. The way you spoke of Athena coming to you, I thought it was longing. Something you kept close, like a secret heart.
I kept it close because I was ashamed. I did not want you to hear how she had preferred my father all along.
She's a fool, but I did not say it.
I do not want to go to Sparta, he said. Nor do I want to stay here. I think you know where I would like to be.
You cannot come, I said. It is not safe for mortals.
I suspect it is not safe at all. You should see your face. You cannot hide either.
What is my face like? I wanted to ask. Instead, I said, you would leave your mother.
She will be well here, and content, I think.
Wood dust floated past, fragrant in the air. It was the same smell that rose from his skin when he carved. I felt reckless suddenly. Sick of all my fretting and convincing, my careful plotting. It came to some by nature, but not to me. If you want to join me, I will not stop you, I said. We leave at dawn. I made my preparations and he made his. We worked until the sky began to pale. The ship was filled with all the stores it could hold. Cheese and toasted barley, fruits dried and fresh. Telemachus added fishing nets and oars, extra rope and knives, all of it carefully stowed and strapped in its place. With rollers, we pushed the boat down to the sea, its hull effortlessly slipping through the breakers. Penelope stood on the shore to wave us off. Telemachus had gone alone to tell her he was leaving. Whatever she thought of it, she kept from her face. Telemachus lifted the sail. The storm was past. The winds were fresh and blowing well. They caught us, and we glided through the bay. I looked back at Aiaia. Twice in all my days I had seen her dwindling behind me. The water grew between us and her cliffs shrank. I could taste the salt spray on my lips. All around were those silver scrolling waves. No thunderbolt came. I was free. No, I thought. Not yet.
Where do we go?
Telemachus's hand waited on the rudder. The last time I had spoken her name aloud had been to his father.
To the straits, I said. To Scylla.
I watched the words register. He maneuvered the prow with competent hands.
You're not frightened? You warned me it was not safe, he said. I do not think being frightened will help.
The sea flowed by. We passed the island where I had stopped with Daedalus on the way to Crete. The beach was still there, and I glimpsed a grove of almond trees. The storm-blasted poplar would be long gone by now, crumbled to earth. A pale smudge appeared on the horizon. With each hour it grew, belling like smoke. I knew what it was. Pull down the sail, I said. We have business here first. Over the rail we caught 12 fish, large as we could find. They thrashed, spraying cold drops of salt across the deck. I pinched my herbs into their gasping mouths and spoke the word. The old cracking sound, the tearing of flesh. And then they were fish no more, but 12 rams, fat and addled. They jostled, eyes rolling, packed against each other in the small space. It was a blessing. They would not have been able to stand otherwise. They were not used to having feet. Telemachus had to climb over them to get to the oars. It may be a little hard to row.
They will not be here long. He frowned at one.
Do they taste like mutton?
I don't know. I lifted from my herb bag the small clay pot that I had filled the night before. It was stoppered with wax and had a looped handle. With a length of leather cord, I tied it around the largest ram's neck. We unfurled the sail. I had warned Telemachus about the mist and spray, and he had a pair of oars ready in makeshift locks. They were awkward, for the boat was meant for sails, but they would help us through if the wind died completely.
We must keep moving, I told him, no matter what.
He nodded as if it would be easy. I knew better. The spear was in my hand, tipped with its poisonous spine, but I had seen how fast she was. I had told Odysseus once that there was no withstanding her, yet here I was again. Lightly, I touched Telemachus's shoulder and whispered a charm. I felt the illusion gather over him. He was gone. Bare deck, empty air. It would not hold up to scrutiny, but it would hide him from her passing glance. He watched, asking no questions. He trusted me. I turned away, abrupt, to face the prow. The mist drifted over us. My hair grew damp and the sucking sound of the whirlpool reached us across the waves. Charybdis. Men had named that vortex. It had claimed its share of sailors, all those who tried to avoid Scylla's appetite. The rams pressed against me, swaying. They made no sound as real sheep would have. They did not know how to use their throats. I pitied them in their trembling, monstrous forms. The straits loomed, and we slipped into their mouth. I glanced at Telemachus. He held the oars ready, his eyes alert. Hairs lifted on my neck. What had I done? I should never have brought him. The smell struck me, familiar even after so long. Rot and hate. And then she came, slithering out of the grey fog. Those old lumpen heads of hers crept along the cliff, rasping as they went. Her bloodshot gaze was fixed on the rams, reeking of fat and fear.
Come, I cried. She struck. Six rams were snatched up in six wide-split jaws. She darted back with them into the mist. I heard bones crunching, the wet gulping of her throats. Blood drizzled down the cliff face. I had time for a single glance at Telemachus. The wind was nearly dead and he was rowing now, intent. The sweat stood out on his arms. Scylla returned, head weaving with malevolence. Tufts of fleece showed between her teeth. Now the rest, I said. She took the other six so fast there was no time to count the beat between my words and their vanishing. The ram with the pot had been among them. I tried to listen for its clay shattering in her teeth, but I could make out nothing above the sounds of bones and flesh. Last night, beneath the cold moon, I had milked the spear's poison. It had trickled, clear and thin, into my polished bronze bowl. I had added dittany, gathered so long ago from Crete, cypress root, shards of my cliff and soil from my garden, and last of all my own red blood. The liquid had foamed and turned yellow. All this I had put into that pot, then sealed it with wax. The draught would be slipping down her throat by now, pooling in her guts. I thought 12 sheep would have dulled the edge of her hunger, but when she returned, her eyes looked the same as ever, greedy and ravening, as if it were not her belly she fed, but an undying rage.
Scylla! I lifted the spear. It is I, Circe, daughter of Helios, witch of Aiaia.
She shrieked, that old baying cacophony clawing at my ears, but there was no recognition in it.
Long ago I changed you to this form from the nymph you were. I come now with Trigon's power to make an end to what I began.
And into the mist-soaked air, I spoke the word of my will. She hissed. Her gaze held not the slightest hint of curiosity. Her heads wove on, searching over the deck as if there might be sheep she had overlooked. Behind me, I could hear Telemachus straining at the oars. Our sail hung limp. He was all that kept us moving forward. I saw the instant her eyes pierced my illusion and spotted him. She moaned, low and eager.
No, I brandished the spear. This mortal is under my protection. You will suffer eternal agony if you try to take him. You see, I have Trigon's tail.
She screamed again. Her breath washed over me, stink and searing heat. The heads were weaving faster in her excitement. They snapped the air, long strands of drool swinging from their jaws. She was afraid of the spear, but that would not hold her for long. She had come to like the taste of mortal flesh. She craved it. Stark black terror rolled through me. I would have sworn I felt the spell take hold. Had I been wrong? Panic drenched my shoulders. I would have to fight her 6 ravening heads at once. I was no trained warrior. One of them would get me, and then Telemachus. I would not let myself finish the thought. My mind spat through ideas, all useless, spells that could not touch her, poisons I did not have, gods who would not come to my aid. I could tell Telemachus to jump and swim, but there was nowhere to go. The only path safe from her reach would take him into the devouring whirlpool of Charybdis. I set myself between her and Telemachus, spear outthrust, nerves drawn up. I must wound her before she gets by me, I told myself. I must at least get Trigon's poison in her blood. I braced for the blow. It did not come. One of her mouths was working strangely, jaws hinging and unhinging. A choking noise came from deep within her chest. She gagged, and a yellow foam ran over her teeth. What is it? I heard Telemachus say. What's happening? There was no time for an answer. Her body sagged out of the mist. I had never seen it before. Gelatinous and huge. As we watched, it scraped down the cliffside above us. Her head squealed and bucked, as if trying to haul it back up again. But it only sank further, as inexorably as if it were weighted with stones. I could see now the beginnings of her legs, those 12 monstrous tentacles stretching away from her body into the mist. She kept them hidden always, Hermes had told me, coiled in the cave among the bones and bits of old flesh, gripping the cave's stone so that the rest of her might dart down for her meals and return. Scylla's heads were snapping and whining, rearing back to bite their own necks. Her grey skin was streaked with yellow foam and her own red blood. A noise began like a boulder drawn across the earth, and suddenly a grey blur tumbled past us, smashing the waves beside our boat. The deck dipped wildly and I nearly lost my balance. When I was steady again, I found myself staring at one of her huge legs. It hung limp off her body, thick as the oldest oak on Aiaia, its end disappearing into the waves. It had let go its hold. We must leave, I said. Now, there will be more. Before the words were out, the dragging sound had begun again. Telemachus cried out a warning. The leg smashed so close to our stern it sucked the rail half beneath the waves. I was knocked to my knees and Telemachus thrown from his seat. He managed to cling to the oars and with effort wrested them back to their places. The waters around us seethed with wash, the boat pitched up and down. In the air over our heads, Scylla cried and thrashed. The weight of the fallen legs had pulled her further down the cliff. The heads were within range now, but she paid no attention to us. She was biting at the limp flesh of her legs, savaging it. I hesitated a moment, then wedged the spear haft against our supplies so it would not roll in the chaos. I seized one of Telemachus's oars. Go! We bent ourselves to rowing. The dragging sound came again and another leg fell, its great surge soaking the deck, slewing the prow towards Charybdis. I caught a glimpse of its whirling chaos that ate ships whole. Telemachus grappled at the rudder, trying to turn us. A rope! He shouted. I scrabbled one out from our stores. He looped it around the rudder, yanking at it, fighting to point us back out of the straits. Scylla's body swayed 2 mast lengths above us. The legs were still falling, and each impact pulled the dangling trunk further down. 10, I counted. 11. We have to go! Telemachus had righted the prow. He tied off the rudder, and we scrambled back to the oars. Beneath the cliff, the boat tossed back and forth in the chopped waters like a fallen leaf. The waves around us were stained yellow. Her remaining legs stretched back up the cliff face. It was all that held her, pulled grotesquely taut. She let go. Her massive body struck the water. The wave ripped the oars from our hands, and my head was buffeted by cold salt. I caught a glimpse of our stores washing into the sea and vanishing with them into the white Trigon spear. I felt the loss like a blow to my chest, but there was no time to think of it. I seized Telemachus's arm, expecting any moment the deck to crack beneath us. But the stout planks held, and the rope on the rudder too. The wash of that last great wave shoved us forward out of the straits. The sound of Charybdis had faded, and the sea lay open around us. I got to my feet and looked back. At the base of the cliff where Scylla had been was a hulking shoal. The outline of six snaky necks was still visible upon it, but they did not move. They would never move again. She had turned to stone. It was a long way to land. My arms and back ached as if they had been whipped, and Telemachus must have been worse. Yet our sail was miraculously intact, and it bore us on. The sun seemed to drop into the sea like a falling plate, and night rose over the water. I sighted land through the star-pricked black, and we dragged the boat onto its beach. We had lost all our fresh water stores, and Telemachus was dull-eyed, nearly speechless. I went to find a river and carried back a brimming bowl I'd transformed from a rock. He drained it, and afterwards he lay still so long I began to be afraid. But at last he cleared his throat and asked what food there was. I had gathered a few berries by then and caught a fish which was spitted over the fire. "I am sorry I put you in such danger," I said. "If you had not been there, we would have been smashed to pieces." He nodded wearily as he chewed. His face was still drawn and pale. "I confess I am glad we will not have to do it again." He leaned back upon the sand, and his eyes drooped closed. He was safe, for our camp was backed into the corner of a cliff, so I left him to walk the shore. I thought we were on an island, but I could not tell for certain. There was no smoke rising above the trees, and when I listened, I heard nothing but night birds and brush and the hiss of waves. There were flowers and forests growing thickly inland, but I did not go look. I was seeing before me again that rocky mass that had been Scylla. She was gone, truly gone. For the first time in centuries, I was not lashed to that flood of misery and grief. No more souls would walk to the underworld written with my name. I faced the sea. It felt strange to have nothing in my hands, no spear haft to carry. I could feel the air moving across my palms, salt mingling with the green scent of spring. I imagined the grey length of the tail, sinking through the darkness to find its master. "Trigon," I said, "your tail comes home to you. I kept it too long, but I made good use of it at last." The soft waves washed across the sand. The darkness felt clean against my skin. I walked through the cool air as if it were a pool I bathed in. We had lost everything but the pouch of tools he had worn at his waist and my spell bag which had been tied to me. We would have to make oars, I thought, and lay in new stores of food. But those thoughts were for tomorrow. I passed a pear tree drifted with white blossoms. A fish splashed in the moonlit river. With every step I felt lighter. An emotion was swelling in my throat. It took me a moment to recognize what it was. I had been old and stern for so long, carved with regrets and years like a monolith. But that was only a shape I had been poured into. I did not have to keep it. Telemachus slept on. His hands were clasped like a child's under his chin. They had been bloodied at the oars, and I had salved them, their warm weight resting in my lap. His fingers had been more calloused than I imagined, but his palms were smooth. So often on Aiaia I had wondered how it would feel to touch him. His eyes opened as if I had spoken the words aloud. They were clear, as they always were. I said, "Scylla was not born a monster. I made her." His face was in the fire's shadows. "How did it happen?" There was a piece of me that shouted its alarm. "If you speak, he will turn grey and hate you." But I pushed past it. If he turned grey, then he did. I would not go on any more, weaving my cloths by day and unravelling them again at night, making nothing. I told him the whole tale of it, each jealousy and folly, and all the lives that had been lost because of me. "Her name," he said,
Scylla. It means the render.
Perhaps it was always her destiny to be a monster, and you were only the instrument.
Do you use the same excuse for the maids you hanged?
It was as if I had struck him.
I make no excuse for that. I will wear that shame all my life. I cannot undo it, but I will spend my days wishing I could.
It is how you know you are different from your father, I said.
Yes.
His voice was sharp.
It is the same for me, I said.
Do not try to take my regret from me.
He was quiet a long time.
You are wise, he said.
If it is so, I said, it is only because I have been fool enough for 100 lifetimes.
Yet at least what you loved, you fought for.
That is not always a blessing.
I must tell you all my past is like today, monsters and horrors no one wants to hear.
He held my gaze. Something about him then reminded me strangely of Trigon, an unearthly quiet patience.
I want to hear, he said.
I had kept away from him for so many reasons, his mother and my son, his father and Athena, because I was a god and he a man. But it struck me then that at the root of all those reasons was a sort of fear, and I have never been a coward. I reached across that breathing air between us and found him. Chapter 26. 3 days we stayed upon that shore. We made no oars and patched no sails. We caught fish and picked fruit and looked for nothing but what we found at our fingers' ends. I laid my palm on his stomach, feeling it rise and fall with his breath. His shoulders were wiry with muscle, the back of his neck roughened with sunburn. I did tell him those stories, by the fire or the morning's light, when our pleasures were set aside. Some of it was easier than I thought it would be. There was a kind of joy in drawing Prometheus for him, in making Ariadne and Daedalus live again. But other parts were not so easy. And sometimes, as I spoke, an anger would come over me, and the words would curdle in my mouth. Who was he to be so patient while I spilled my blood? I was a woman grown. I was a goddess, and his elder by 1,000 generations. I did not need his pity, his attention, anything.
Well, I would demand, why don't you say something?
I am listening, he would answer.
You see,
I said when I was finished with the tale,
gods are ugly things.
We are not our blood, he answered.
A witch once told me that.
On the third day he cut new oars, and I transformed water skins and filled them, then gathered up fruit. I watched him rig the sail with easy competence, check the hull for any leaks. I said, I don't know what I was thinking. I cannot sail a boat. What would I have done if you hadn't come? He laughed.
You would have gotten there eventually. It just would have taken some of your eternity. Where do we go next?
Ashore, east of Crete. There is a small cove, half sand, half rocks, and a scrub forest in sight, and hills. Overhead, at this time of the year, the dragon seems to point the way. He raised his eyebrows. If you get me close enough, I think I'll be able to find it. I watched him.
Are you going to ask what is there?
I do not think you want me to. Less than a month we had spent together, yet he seemed to know me better than anyone who had ever walked the world. It was a smooth voyage, the wind fresh and the sun still shy of its blistering summer heat. At night, we made our camp on whatever shores we could find. He was used to living like a herder, and I found I did not miss my gold and silver bowls, my tapestries. We roasted our fish on stick ends. I carried fruits in my dress. If there was a house, we might offer services in return for bread and wine and cheese. He carved toys for children, patched skiffs. I had my salves, and if I kept my head covered, I could pass for a herb woman coming to ease their aches and fevers. Their gratitude was simple and plain, and ours was the same. No one knelt. While the boat sailed beneath the blue arched sky, we would sit together on the boards talking of the people we had met, the coastlines we passed, the dolphins that followed us for half the morning, grinning and splashing at our rails.
Do you know, he said, that before coming to Aiaia, I only left Ithaca once. I nodded. I have seen Crete and some islands on the way, and that is all. I have always wished to go to Egypt.
Yes, he said. And Troy, and the great cities of Sumeria.
Assur, I said. And I want to see Ethiopia, and the north as well, the ice rib lands, and Telegonus's new kingdom in the west. We looked out over the waves, and a silence hung between us. The next sentence should be, let us go together. But I could not speak that. Not now, and perhaps not ever. And he would keep silent, for he did know me well. Your mother, I said. Do you think she'll be angry at us? He snorted.
No, he said. She likely knew before we did.
I would not be surprised if we come back and find her a witch.
It always made me happy to startle him, to see his evenness blown wide.
What?
Oh, yes, I said. She has eyed my herbs from the beginning. I would have taught her if there had been time. I will wager with you. If you are so sure, I do not think I will take your odds. At night, we crossed the hollows of each other's skin, and when he slept, I would lay beside him, feeling the warmth where our limbs touched, watching the soft pulse at his throat. His eyes had creases, and his neck had more. When people saw us, they thought I was younger. But though I looked and sounded like a mortal, I was a bloodless fish. From my water I could see him, and all the sky behind, but I could not cross over. Between the dragon and Telemachus, we did at last find my old shore. It was morning when we reached the narrow bay, my father's chariot halfway to its peak. Telemachus held the anchor stone. Drop, or draw unto the sand.
Drop,
I said. Hundreds of years of tides and storms had changed the shoreline's shape, but my feet remembered the sand's fineness, the rough grass with its burrs. In the distance drifted faint grey smoke and the sound of goat bells. I passed the jutting rocks where Aietes and I used to sit. I passed the forest where I had lain after my father burned me, now only a stand of straggling pines. The hills I had dragged Glaucus up were crowded with spring, straw flowers and hyacinths, lilies, violets, and sweet rock roses, and at their center, the small clutch of yellow flowers sprung from Kronos's blood. The old humming note rose up as if in greeting. Do not touch them, I said to Telemachus, but even as the words were out, I realized how foolish they were. The flowers could do nothing to him. He was himself already. I would not see a hair changed. Using my knife, I dug up each stalk by its roots. I wrapped them with soil in strips of cloth and settled them in the darkness of my bag. There was no more reason to linger. We hauled up the anchor and pointed the prow towards home. The waves and islands passed, but I scarcely saw them. I was drawn, taut as an archer, sighting against the sky, waiting for the bird to flush. On the last evening, when Aiaia was so close I thought I could smell her blooms drifting on the sea air, I told him the story that I had kept back, of the first men who had come to my island, and what I had done to them in return. The stars were very bright, and Vesper shone like a flame overhead. I did not tell you before because I did not want it to lie between us. And now you do not mind if it does? From the darkness of my bag, the flowers sang their yellow note. Now I want you to have the truth, whatever comes. The light salt breeze rifled in the shore grass. He was holding my hand against his chest. I could feel the steady beat of his blood. I have not pressed you, he said, and still I will not. I know there are reasons you cannot answer me, but if... He stopped. I want you to know, if you go to Egypt, if you go anywhere, I want to go with you. Pulse by pulse, his life passed under my fingers. Thank you, I said. Penelope met us on Aiaia's shore. The sun was high, and the island bloomed wildly, fruits swelling on their branches, new green growth leaping from every crook and crevice. She looked at ease amid that profusion, waving to us, calling her greetings. If she noticed a change between us, she said nothing. She embraced us both. It had been quiet, she said, no visitors, yet not quiet at all. More lion cubs had been born. A mist had covered the East Bay for 3 days, and there had been such a torrent of rain that the stream burst its banks. Her cheeks showed her blood as she talked. We wound past the glossy laurels, the rhododendrons, through my garden and the great oak doors. I breathed my house's air, thick with the clean smell of herbs. I felt that pleasure the bards sing of so often. Homecoming. In my room, the sheets of my wide gold bed were fresh as they ever were. I could hear Telemachus telling his mother the story of Scylla. I left and went barefoot to walk the island. The earth was warm beneath my feet. The flowers tossed their bright heads. A lion followed at my heels. Was I saying farewell? I was pointed up into the sky's wide arch. Tonight, I thought. Tonight, beneath the moon, alone. I came back when the sun was setting. Telemachus had gone to catch fish for dinner, and Penelope and I sat at the table. Her fingertips were stained green, and I could smell the spells in the air. I have long wondered something, I said. When we fought over Athena, how did you know to kneel to me, that it would shame me? Ah, it was a guess, something Odysseus said about you once. Which was? That he had never met a god who enjoyed their divinity less. I smiled. Even dead, he could surprise me. I suppose that is true. You said that he shaped kingdoms, but he also shaped the thoughts of men. Before him, all the heroes were Heracles and Jason. Now children will play at voyaging, conquering hostile lands with wits and words. He would like that, she said. I thought he would too. A moment passed, and I looked at her stained hands on the table before me. And? Are you going to tell me? How goes your witchery? She smiled her inward smile. You are right. It is mostly will. Will and work. I am finished here, I said. One way or another. Would you like to be witch of Aiaia in my place? I think I would. I think I truly would. My hair, though, it is not right. It looks nothing like yours. You could dye it? She made a face. I will say instead it has gone grey from my haggish sorceries. We laughed. She had finished the tapestry, and it hung behind her on the wall, that swimmer striking out into the stormy deep. If you find yourself in want of company, I said, tell the gods you will take their bad daughters. I think you will have the right touch for them. I will consider that a compliment. She rubbed at a smudge on the table. And what about my son? Will he be going with you? I realized I felt almost nervous. If he wants to. And what do you want? I want him to come, I said. If it is possible. But there is a thing which still lies before me to be done. I do not know what will come of it. Her calm gray eyes held mine. Her brow was arched like a temple, I thought. Graceful and enduring. Telemachus has been a good son. Longer than he should have been. Now he must be his own. She touched my hand. Nothing is sure, we know that. But if I had to trust that a thing would be done, I would trust it to you. I carried our dishes away, washed them carefully until they shone. My knives I wetted and laid each in its place. I wiped down the tables, I swept the floor. When I came back to my hearth, only Telemachus was there. We walked to the small clearing we both loved. The one where, a lifetime ago, we had spoken of Athena. The spell I mean to do, I said. I do not know what will happen when I cast it. It may not even work. Perhaps Cronus's power cannot be carried from its soil. He said, then we will go back. We will go back until you are satisfied. It was so simple. If you want it, I will do it. If it would make you happy, I will go with you. Is there a moment that a heart cracks? But a cracked heart was not enough, and I had grown wise enough to know it. I kissed him and left him there. Chapter 27 The frogs had gone to their wallows. The salamanders slept in brown holes. The pools showed the moon's half face, the pinpoints of stars, and all around, bending near, the wavering trees. I knelt on the bank, thick with grass. Before me was the old bronze bowl I had used for my magics since the very first. The flowers rested beside me in their pale root swaddles. Stem by stem, I cut them and squeezed out the drops of running sap. The bottom of the bowl grew dark. It too began to show the moon. The last flower I did not squeeze, but planted there on the shore, where the sun fell every morning. Perhaps it would grow. I could feel the fear in myself, gleaming like water. These flowers had made Scylla a monster, though all she had done was sneer. Glaucus had become a monster of sorts too, everything that was kind in him driven out by Godhead. I remembered my old terror from Telegonus's birth. What creature awaits within me? My imagination conjured up horrors. I would sprout slimy heads and yellow teeth. I would stalk down to the hollow and savage Telemachus to pieces. But perhaps, I told myself, it would not be like that. Perhaps all I hoped would come to pass, and Telemachus and I would go to Egypt indeed, and all those other places. We would cross and recross the seas, living on my witchcraft and his carpentry, and when we came to a town a second time, the people would step out of their houses to greet us. He would patch their ships, and I would cast charms against biting flies and fevers, and we would take pleasure in the simple mending of the world. The vision blossomed, vivid as the cool grass beneath me, as the black sky over my head. We would visit the Lion Gate of Mycenae, where Agamemnon's heirs ruled, and the walls of Troy, their stones chilled by winds from ice-peaked Ida. We would ride elephants and walk in the desert night beneath the eyes of gods who had never heard of Titans or Olympians, who took no more notice of us than they did of the sand beetles toiling at our feet. He would say to me that he wanted children, and I would say, "You do not know what you are asking of me." And he would say, "This time you are not alone. We have a daughter, and then another. Penelope attends my birthing bed. There is pain, but it passes. We live on the island when the children are young, and visit often after. She weaves and casts spells while nymphs glide around her. However gray she gets, she never seems to tire. But sometimes I see her eyes turn to the horizon where the house of the dead and its souls wait. The daughters I dream to life are different from Telegonus, and different from each other. One chases the lions in circles while the other sits in a corner, watching and remembering everything. We are wild with our love for them, standing over their sleeping faces, whispering about what she said today, what she did. We bring them to meet Telegonus, throned among his golden orchards. He leaps from his couch to embrace us all and introduces us to his captain of the guard, a tall, dark-haired youth who never leaves his side. He is not married yet. He may not ever be, he says. I smile, imagining Athena's frustration. So polite he is, yet firm and immovable as one of his own city walls. I do not worry for him. I have aged. When I look in my polished bronze mirror, there are lines upon my face. I am thickened, too, and my skin has begun growing loose. I cut myself at my herbs, and the scars stay. Sometimes I like it. Sometimes I am vain and dissatisfied. But I do not wish myself back. Of course, my flesh reaches for the earth. That is where it belongs. One day, Hermes will lead me down to the halls of the dead. We will scarcely recognize each other, for I will be white-haired, and he will be wrapped in his mystery as leader of souls, the only time he is solemn. I think I will enjoy saying that. I know how lucky I am, stupid with luck, crammed with it, stumbling drunk. I wake sometimes in the dark, terrified by my life's precariousness, its thready breath. Beside me, my husband's pulse beats at his throat. In their beds, my children's skin shows every faintest scratch. A breeze would blow them over, and the world is filled with more than breezes. Diseases and disasters, monsters and pain in a thousand variations. I do not forget either my father and his kind hanging over us. Bright and sharp as swords aimed at our tearing flesh. If they do not fall on us in spite and malice, then they will fall by accident or whim. My breath fights in my throat. How can I live on beneath such a burden of doom? I rise then and go to my herbs. I create something. I transform something. My witchcraft is as strong as ever, stronger. This too is good fortune. How many have such power and leisure and defense as I do? Telemachus comes from our bed to find me. He sits with me in the green-smelling darkness, holding my hand. Our faces are both lined now, marked with our years. Circe, he says, it will be all right. It is not the saying of an oracle or a prophet. They are words you might speak to a child. I have heard him say them to our daughters when he rocked them back to sleep from a nightmare, when he dressed their small cuts, soothed whatever stung. His skin is familiar as my own beneath my fingers. I listen to his breath, warm upon the night air, and somehow I am comforted. He does not mean that it does not hurt. He does not mean that we are not frightened, only that we are here. This is what it means to swim in the tide, to walk the earth and feel it touch your feet. This is what it means to be alive. Overhead, the constellations dip and wheel. My divinity shines in me like the last rays of the sun before they drown in the sea. I thought once that gods are the opposite of death, but I see now they are more dead than anything, for they are unchanging and can hold nothing in their hands. All my life, I have been moving forward, and now I am here. I have a mortal's voice. Let me have the rest. I lift the brimming bowl to my lips and drink. This has been a Hachette audio production of Circe, a novel. Written by Madeline Miller. Read by Perdita Weeks. Produced and directed by Lisa Kahn. Recorded by Lydia Thompson at the Strathmore Studios, London. Post-production by Audio Media Production, New York. This program includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of the cast of characters. Circe is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018, Madeline Miller. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.